So I guess I can start with what I'm here for, and that is to introduce Anders Mohler, about which quite a bit could be said. Let me just say that I met him several years ago at Uppsala. He was for a number of years on the faculty at the University of Uppsala, having gotten his undergraduate and graduate training at various places in Denmark. Now he's back in Denmark at the University of, he's a professor at the University of Copenhagen. The interesting things about Anders Mohler is not where he comes from or where he is, it's what he does. And the sorts of things he does are frequently apparent. I seldom open any of the journals I normally get or browse without finding at least one article in there with Anders Mohler's name as one of the authors. And it involves I won't even try to summarize the diversity of sorts of things that he does. Various aspects of animal behavior, analogous things with plants, sexual selection in plants, for instance. I noticed something about immunology in the list of interests that he has. So I think that's sufficient indication. Now, okay, there's the quantity and the diversity. The quality is even more impressive, I would say. That's my intuitive impression, and I suspect very much that you'll agree after we've heard from him. Now, as usual, when I get up to introduce a speaker, I don't remember what the title is, but it has something to do with asymmetry, and I think I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you very much for this introduction. The title is shown on this slide here. So what I'm going to talk about today is some work that I've been interested in for the last years. And there's a number of other people who are interested in this problem of developmental stability of various kinds of organisms. I'll mainly be talking about humans and use human examples, but there are similar kinds of examples for a wide range of different kinds of organisms. My talk today is going to touch on a number of different subjects that are related to developmental stability. Among these, developmental stability and sexual selection, I'll talk a little bit about how the developmental stability of organisms might indicate susceptibility to parasites and diseases. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about handedness in humans. We are all aware of the fact that if we look at organisms in our surroundings, including our own species, they display a staggering degree of symmetry, either bilateral or radial. What is also quite easy to realize when you start watching humans or animals for that matter is that performance is directly related to this symmetry. This dive would have been much less perfect if one of the legs were twisted out to one side. So there is a direct relationship between symmetry and performance, and I'll come back to that later. The reason why these problems of developmental stability that I'll define in a couple of minutes is important is that it tells us something about how the organisms experience their environment. If you look at any kind of organism, you can measure the performance of this organism along some kind of environmental axis, like this x-axis here. And independently of which variable you choose, you will find some kind of optimum. At lower levels, the individuals will perform less well, and at higher levels, they'll also perform less well, and eventually they'll either disappear or die. There are many studies showing this, and this is just a simple example from salmon eggs, where you have the metabolism of the eggs on this axis, and there's a certain temperature range at which this metabolism reaches a minimum, and this range coincides with the temperature range at which the survival of the embryos, as shown over there, reaches a maximum. But it's not just metabolism that's related to these environmental gradients, it's also other kinds of performance, and among these the extent to which individuals are able to reach a stable phenotype during their ontogeny. And these negative effects in terms of how the phenotype develops are termed developmental instability. If you look at bilateral organisms, you can study the morphological variation, the difference between the size of your hands and as two different components. One of them is that there is an average or mean size, but there's also some variation between the two sides, and that is what I'm going to talk about, fluctuating asymmetry. You are all aware of some friends who use shoes of different sizes, for example. And this is one example of this phenomenon. But I have to stress that there's other kinds of asymmetry that is not particularly interesting in this context, and two of these are directional asymmetry and anti-symmetry. These three different kinds of asymmetry are illustrated here. At the top, you have a directional asymmetry, and that occurs when, in a particular organism, its individuals always have a larger character to a particular side of the body. Anti-symmetry, as shown here, in such organisms or such characters, symmetry is very rare, and most individuals are asymmetric, but there's no sidedness with respect to this asymmetry. Fluctuating asymmetry, on the other hand, is characterized by most individuals being symmetric and fewer being asymmetric, but there's no directionality in this asymmetry, so you get a nice normal distribution with an average of zero if you look at the difference between the left and the right side of a particular character. One example of a directional asymmetry that I don't want to show is in mammals, including our own species, asymmetry in testicle size is directional. An example of anti-symmetry is fiddler crabs. Here you have one male with a nice claw they use for waving at other males and females. And in these fiddler crab populations, it's either the right or the left claw that's enlarged. An example of fluctuating asymmetry comes from my own studies of this bird here, the barn swallow, and I measured a number of different morphological characters in this species. Among these, the size of these outermost tail feathers. And if you measure a large number of individuals, you get distributions like this. Most of the individuals are rather symmetric, but there are some that are quite asymmetric, up to 20 or more millimeters differences between the sides in the length of these tail feathers. So this is one example of a measure of developmental stability. And by developmental stability, I mean the ability of individuals of a particular genotype to undergo stable morphogenesis under a range of different environmental conditions. You can measure developmental stability in a number of different ways, and one measure is, as I've indicated, this fluctuating asymmetry. Another way of measuring it is in terms of phenodeviance, and by phenodeviance I mean traits that deviate from the normal phenotype, and one example is in humans. Almost all humans have the heart in the left side of their body, but there are a few individuals that have it on the other side, and that's an example of a phenodeviant. You can also perhaps look at developmental stability in other dimensions, and there's currently a lot of interest in how to measure developmental stability in terms of behavior, for example. So fluctuating asymmetry, in other words, is small random deviations from symmetry in otherwise bilaterally symmetric characters. The reason why fluctuating asymmetry is different from other kinds of characters is that we, for any character, we can go out and measure selection on that particular character by studying survivors and non-survivors in natural populations, for example. And in that way, we can calculate the optimum. But for fluctuating asymmetry, we know beforehand the optimum, which is symmetry. The second reason why fluctuating asymmetry is important is that we can't go out in nature and ask animals and plants how they feel today. We can, but they will not get an answer. But we can look at their phenotypes, how they develop in the environment where they're living, and use deviations from this optimum symmetric phenotype as a measure of how they've experienced the environment in which they grew up. So if we measure a random organism such as a number of Drosophila fruit flies, and we measure the left wings and the right wings, we'll get normal frequency distributions. If we look at the right minus left size of these wings in these individual fruit flies, we'll again get a normal distribution with, as I said, an average value of zero, which is the definition of a character showing a fluctuating asymmetry. Some of you might think that this is perhaps a rather new phenomenon, that people have started looking at these asymmetries in various kinds of organisms, but that's far from true. The story about how these studies came about is quite interesting. This rather famous statue, Venus from Milo, was found in Greece quite a long time ago, and after a while, the French ambassador in Turkey bought the statue and sent it off to Paris, where it was put in a museum. There was a German art historian who went to Paris and investigated this statue, and he wrote a rather thick book about the statue and all its virtues. And he praised the beauty of this statue. There was another German who read this book. I'm quite sure that there were not very many that read the book because it's very thick and not very interesting. But anyway, this medical doctor who happened to flip through the book, he became quite upset because when he looked at the body of this statue, and he realized that this body was quite distorted. And the best guess he could make was that this was a very hard-working woman from the countryside who had posed for this Greek sculpture. So this German medical doctor then wrote a rebuttal to the book, and this was published, and it was read by quite a few people, particularly in the medical sciences, and that was the starting point for studies of these deviations from bilateral symmetry, and lots of people in the medical profession started to look at deviations from perfect bilateral symmetry. And later on, biologists took over and started similar studies in other organisms. Third feature that makes fluctuating asymmetry an interesting concept is that there's a number of different studies of a wide range of organisms that have shown that these deviations from perfect symmetry come about because of different kinds of stress, and these can be classified into what I call genetic stress and environmental stress. And by genetic stress, I mean phenomena that disrupt the ability of the individual to produce a symmetric phenotype. For example, high levels of homozygosity or high levels of inbreeding give elevated levels of fluctuating asymmetry. And in the same vein, a wide range of different kinds of environmental factors, such as the quality or quantity of nutrients given to offspring during ontogeny, affects their level of asymmetry. Parasites and pathogens increase levels of asymmetry, and so does chemical substances such as pesticides. In other words, you can use these deviations from symmetry as a measure of how the individual has experienced its environment in terms of a wide range of environmental components given its particular genetic setup. I'll just show you an example of how these studies look like. And in this particular example here, it's a study of fucus algae. And these two individuals were growing in different areas. The measure of fluctuating asymmetry was simply the maximum length of these two lobes. And this was measured in a large number of individuals at different distances from a chemical factor. And if you plot the difference in the length of these lobes against the distance from this chemical factory, you see a very marked decrease. At 7 kilometers distance, they are very symmetric, but the fucus that are growing very close to this this polluting factory are very asymmetric. A second example concerns smoking. This is a study done by John Manning, where he measured a number of people in the department where he's working. And these were classified into non-smokers and smokers. And then he measured skeletal asymmetry in a large number of traits and averaged these asymmetries. And what he could find was that smokers on average were much more asymmetric than non-smokers. You might say that this is perhaps nonsense because the skeleton is a stable structure that doesn't change, but that's not quite true because all these chemical substances that are in the skeleton are circulated and replaced. So if some of the contents in tobacco disrupts this ability to maintain a symmetrical phenotype, then you might get relationships like this. And it's not just tobacco. If we turn to other substances like alcohol, you get similar kinds of effects. This example here is a study of asymmetry in fingerprints in newly born children. This is a group of children that were suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome. These were children born by mothers that had consumed some alcohol during pregnancy, and this was a control group born by mothers that had not consumed alcohol. And as you can see, there's a quite dramatic difference in these fingerprint asymmetries in relation to what the mothers have been doing during their pregnancy. There's been lots of discussion whether or not this ability to control this stable development has a genetic basis. Some studies have shown this, others have not. And people have been fighting and arguing that some are wrong and others are right. And so because of this confusion, I did a review together with Randy Thornhill where we collected all the data from, I think now there's 35 studies. And if you do that, you will find out that the average heritability is 0.28, which is a relatively high value. So there is resemblance between offspring and their parents in how well they're able to control a stable development. As I started by saying, performance decreases with increasing developmental instability. And it is perhaps so obvious that you don't really need examples of this, but it's quite clear that if you are extremely asymmetric, as this Wilhelm Tell painted by Salvador Dali, it's not easy to do whatever you are supposed to do. A second example of performance in relation to asymmetry comes from Switzerland. In Switzerland, there is a group of Rudolf Steiner people who are, I would call them, fundamentalists. They have particular ideas about how to do things, and one of the things is that you can't build houses with four right angles in a window or a door. For that reason, these houses become extremely expensive, because you can't buy just an ordinary house or go to a bricklayer and make him build an ordinary house. And obviously, this community is quite small, so the success of this line of thought has been rather limited. A third example of how asymmetry is related to performance, again, comes from a study done by John Manning and one of his students on racehorses. And what they did was that they went out and measured a number of the morphological traits in these racehorses, and then he looked. They looked at how these racehorses were performing, and what they found was that the rating of these racehorses was related to their average relative asymmetry. Very asymmetric horses had lower ratings and were able to win less often in these horse races. There are many other examples of how performance is related to asymmetry, but I'll not go through more of those now. And now, after this brief introduction to the subject, speak a little bit more in detail about three aspects of how asymmetry is related to humans and human behavior. And the first one concerns the mental stability and human sexual selection or human attractiveness. Particularly, psychologists have for many, many years been engaged in studies of what makes certain individuals attractive and others less attractive. And this has been done in a number of different ways, these studies, and there's some agreement about what makes particular individuals attractive. One of the features that have been studied is facial attractiveness. And you know that if you look around, faces are asymmetric, but if you make mirror images, the faces, as Edgar Allan Poe in this example here, look quite strange, and you can also see that these mirror images of the left or the right half of the face, they are obviously quite different. What has been shown in a large number of studies of the attractiveness in relation to how faces look like has been claimed to be that the average face is the most attractive. And the reason why psychologists have been arguing that this is the case is that if you take a number of photographs of different faces and put the negatives on top of each other, the more negatives you stack, the more attractive is the face, up to a certain threshold level, of course. It levels off this increasing attractiveness. And the argument has been that if you put on these negatives on top of each other, you are really generating the average face in the population. It was only recently that Carl Grammer and Randy Thornhill realized that there is a fallacy in this kind of argument, and that is, if you put negatives on top of each other, you also even out all the asymmetries, because asymmetries are random with respect to size. And for that reason, this average face also will be very symmetric. So therefore, this attractiveness, this averageness, is confounded by symmetry. And what they've done in two studies now is that they have been able to manipulate asymmetries by putting these landmarks on faces in computers and manipulate the the level of asymmetry independent of the averageness of the face, and shown that there is an effect of both features. Faces that are similar to the average face in the population are more attractive, but so are faces that are more symmetric. If we go to what some people will call secondary sexual characters, and one trait that I'll talk a little bit about is breasts in humans. One study that has been done on this subject was made by Devendra Singh from Texas. And what he did was he had in his psychology class a number of practicals. And one of these practicals was that he provided the students with these drawings of a standard American woman, I guess, and then asked the students to rank these drawings with respect to various aspects of the attractiveness. The drawings differed in terms of breast asymmetry, as you can see here, and also in terms of waist to hip ratio, but I'll not talk more about that. What he could find in this study was that this breast asymmetry had some significant effect on these mean ratings along these different dimensions of that the students were asked to rate the drawings. Of course, one can start asking, what does these ratings mean? What does this breast asymmetry mean? Is there any benefit if there is an actual choice based on this particular trait? And one answer to this question comes from a study of breast asymmetry in two different populations, one Spanish and one USAN population, where breast asymmetry was measured in a large number of women, and so was the fecundity of these women. And as you can see, in both these samples, there's a decrease in fecundity with increasing asymmetry. So the women that had zero or very few children during their lifetime were on average more asymmetric. And that could be the origin for these kinds of preferences. Recently, there's been some increasing interest in human sexual behavior and if we are able to predict human sexual behavior. And the reason for this is obviously that lots of people are interested in studying the spread of AIDS and other venereal diseases. So we need basic information on sexual behavior in humans. It's not easy to go out and ask people because if you ask them, they come up with funny answers. The average number of intercourses among men is much, much higher than the average among the women, and that doesn't fit together. So. This is not a perfect way of studying sexual behavior in humans. What Randy Thornhill and Steve Gangster did was that they, in their classes in the university, measured the asymmetry of these students, or the students were measuring each other, and the students were also asked to fill in a questionnaire about various aspects of their lives, and one of these aspects was age at first sex. On this axis here, you have a measure of fluctuating asymmetry where 300 is very asymmetric and minus 200 is very symmetric. And you can see for this sample of men from this particular study that the age of first sex was related to this measure of skeletal asymmetry. And so was the number of lifetime sexual partners, both in men and in women. More asymmetric individuals had fewer lifetime sexual partners. These are, of course, only self-reported estimates of sexual behavior. We don't know if this is how it is. But one reason why it might be not only what people say, but also what they do, is that they also found that the frequency of venereal disease was related to symmetry. So very symmetric individuals reported a higher frequency of venereal disease. In other words, I've tried to show some data that indicates that attractiveness is positively correlated with the one measure of developmental stability. Self-reported sexual behavior is related to fluctuating asymmetry, and the frequency of self-reported venereal diseases is also related to this measure of morphology. If we go to the next topic, how developmental stability is related to parasitism and disease. The reason why people have started studying this subject is that parasitized individuals are often stressed. You know that from yourself, that if you had a few extremely busy weeks and you are just barely able to cope, that's the time when you go down with a cold or some other kind of infection. And this is a quite general phenomenon in a range of different organisms. One example is one study I've done on elm and leaf miners in elm leaves. These leaf mining insects are very abundant. People have not been very successful in predicting their abundance. So what is it that makes some leaves particularly attractive to these leaf mining insects? And among ecologists, it's well known that stressed plants on average are eaten more often by herbivores. And since, as I've indicated, stress generally increases the level of asymmetry, perhaps you would be able to predict herbivory from asymmetry in these plants. And the measure of asymmetry I've used in this example here is simply the difference in the maximum width of the two leaf halves. And the result was as follows. If we start by looking at these white bars here, the level of asymmetry in these leaves was much higher in leaves that were infested with one of these mining insects than in a leaf that had no mine. But it's not just because of the presence of this leaf mining insect that they became asymmetric, because the nearest neighboring leaf without the mine showed exactly the same pattern. And if you look at or compare neighboring trees with the more or fewer mines, you get exactly the same kind of relationship. The trees with more mines have leaves that are more asymmetric. And you can study this in a number of different ways. One of them is you can simply plot the abundance of these leaf mining insects in relation to the average level of leaf asymmetry in different trees. And as you can see, there's an increasing tendency in this data set. A second example concerns this domestic fly that you know from your own house, irritating small beasts. And both these flies that are sitting on my notebook are dead. But they are dead for different reasons. That one over there, you might be able to see that it has some light bands on the abdomen. These light bands are spores from a fungus that has killed this fly. It's a sexually transmitted disease because the spores are transferred among individuals having sex. This fly here is dead for another reason. What I did in one study was that I transferred these spores to flies that differed in asymmetry, and I looked at the infection rate. The measure of asymmetry was simply the length of the wings, or the difference in the length of the wings. And for both males and females, wing asymmetry was considerably higher for individuals that became infected as compared to individuals that were able to escape this serious infection with this fungus. So the susceptibility to this fungus disease in this particular case was clearly related to how asymmetric that individual was. If we look at the human medical literature, we can find a large number of studies also showing relationships between different kinds of diseases and various measures of developmental instability. And for all these examples that I've listed here, there's an increased frequency of the fluctuating asymmetry of phenodeviance in individuals suffering from these different kinds of genetic perturbations. And if we look at various aspects of mental health, we find similar kinds of phenomena. Again, all the different problems that individuals suffer from having these various kinds of diseases are related to elevated levels of either fluctuating asymmetry or higher frequencies of phenodeviance. One example is this particular study here, where you can see the frequency of phenodeviance in relation to how seriously affected individuals in a mental hospital were. The individuals furthest over there were most seriously affected by their diseases, whereas those over here were much less. We can also look at fecundity in humans and how that relates to these measures of developmental stability. And it's known from studies of humans that fetuses that were spontaneously aborted had higher degrees of fingerprint phenodeviations or asymmetries. And we also know that aborted fetuses have a higher frequency of abnormal karyotypes that we also know are associated with elevated levels of fluctuating asymmetry and high levels of phenodeviance. We can, of course, ask ourselves, most of these examples I've been talking about for humans, they are mere correlations, and of course there might be many confounding factors that may invalidate some of these studies. But if it's the case that asymmetric individuals on average more often suffer from parasitism or disease, what could be the reason? And one possibility is that there's immune deficiency associated with the developmental instability, and that there's evidence from that, both from my own studies of swallows, but also from some studies of humans. There's quite a large number of studies on non-human organisms, and I have recently reviewed this literature, and in 26 out of these 27 studies that have been made on a wide range of different kinds of non-human organisms, there was this relationship between parasitism and these measures of developmental stability. So, to conclude, the frequency of parasitism and disease is negatively related to developmental stability, and as I showed in the example with the flies, and the susceptibility to parasites is also related to this measure of developmental instability. The final thing I want to talk about today concerns handedness and developmental stability. I don't know, perhaps you're not aware of this, but to me at least, it's a paradox why there are so many left-handed people. And I'll try to demonstrate this paradox for you. One piece of information that has been reported in a number of different studies is that the percentage of left-handed people is higher in men than in women. And I've just shown two of these studies here. It's also been shown that developmental instability is higher in left-handed people. Here on the x-axis you have a measure of hand performance. So instead of talking about right or left-handed people, we are talking about the degree of handedness. So So it's a continuous measure of handiness, and it's simply measured as the ability to move pegs in standardized tests. These negative values over here are extremely right-handed people, and the positive values are extremely left-handed people. So you can see, on average, there is a higher frequency of right-handed as compared to left-handed people. The full drawn line here is the line describing the relationship between handedness and a measure of developmental stability measured as fluctuating asymmetry and frequency of phenodeviance in these individuals. And you can see that the level for the left-handed people is much, much higher than for the right-handed. So developmental stability and handedness goes together. There's some indications that handedness and fitness also is related. And I have listed a number of different measures of fitness components that are related to handedness. And there's some evidence for all of these features. For example, left-handed people on average have fewer children. They have more spontaneous abortions. Left-handed women are older at puberty and they're younger at menopause. They die at earlier ages. They suffer from more accidents. And they have problems with their immune defense. And a number of studies have also shown that left-handers are overrepresented among children born with their very low birth weight. And just to show you some of the data, this is one study on a number of children in relation to handedness, and you can see there is a relatively large difference among these two samples. If we look at injuries, a number of different studies have shown that handedness and the frequency of injuries, but also the severity of these injuries, is related to handedness. Of course, I'm sure you are sitting there and thinking, well, it's not so strange because our entire society is made by right-handed people. So it would be not surprising if left-handed people don't perform so well. But if we take accidents caused by driving, it doesn't matter so much if people drive in the wrong side of the road as in this island, or as in the continent where they drive on the right side. So I don't think that this is the entire story. And as I said, also the severity of these accidents is also higher for the left-handed individuals. And as I said earlier, longevity and handedness also appear to go together. And in this particularly study by Halpern and Corin, as you can see, there is quite a dramatic difference in longevity. This might not matter so much if people are post-reproductive when they die, because that will have no consequences necessary for their fitness. But if some of these accidents take place at young age, of course, it might affect their fecundity. Finally, there is a number of people who strongly claim that handedness has a genetic basis. So, given that there are these apparent fitness costs of handedness, we should expect left-handedness to decrease in frequency during time. There's one test of this, because you can go out and estimate handedness in prehistoric or historic populations, because various kinds of artifacts look different if they're made by a right-handed or left-handed person. And this was the result of one such study by Corin and Porak, where they showed that during the last 5,000 years, the frequency of left-handed people has remained approximately constant, around 10%. So that's the paradox. There are all these apparent costs. The trait is apparently heritable. But what we see is a constant frequency. So how can we explain this paradox? And the hypothesis that I come up with together with some French geneticist is that left-handedness perhaps is maintained by frequency-dependent selection. And our argument is that left-handers experience an advantage in fight with right-handers, while the opposite is not the case. A right-handed person who meets a left-handed person will not be used to interacting with a left-handed person, whereas a left-handed person meeting right-handed people will be used to that experience. And that gives left-handed persons an advantage in that particular context. One could also say that there could be other kinds of interactions between right and left-handed persons where a similar kind of benefit might apply. We tried to test this, and the best we could think of was to investigate handedness in people doing performing different kinds of sports. Because in sports, people are really keen to win. They do as much as they can. And we classified sports into interactive and non-interactive sports. And by non-interactive sports, I mean things like swimming or gymnastics, or where you also try to win, but you haven't got a direct opponent whom you are trying to defeat. In one data set, we went to a French university and investigated the frequency of handedness. And what we found was that in the student population as such, there was no deviation in the frequency of left-handedness when we compared it to these general population estimates we have from a range of different studies. For the non-interactive sports, there was a slight increase in left-handedness, and for the interactive sports, there was a further increase. And these differences are statistically significant. But the more important way of testing this is perhaps to look at different kinds of sports. And here I plotted the frequency of left-handedness for a range of different kinds of sports. And you can see that, for example, in fencing, there's a staggering proportion of 30% left-handed people. Whereas for gymnastics, it's as in the population at large. A second result that came out of this study was that we could show that when we went from local clubs and the champions there to the national clubs and then to the champions at the international level, there was a steady increase in the frequency of left-handers. So indicating there's some kind of selection going on there. It's the left-handers that go on to the next level that's more difficult where it's more difficult to defeat your opponents. So, in conclusion, what I've tried to say is that left-handers have an elevated level of developmental instability, and left-handedness appears to be associated with some fitness costs. Left-handers, as far as we can see, have a frequency-dependent advantage in fights, and these are mainly the kinds of fights where it's fencing or some other kinds of interactive sports where some kind of instrument is used. And therefore, perhaps left-handedness is maintained by frequency-dependent selection. So what I've tried to do in this talk here is that I try to convince you that even small differences in the length of morphological characters, as in these barn swallows here, might tell us something important about various phenomena in nature. And I would be happy to discuss or answer questions not only about handedness, but also about developmental stability in general. Thank you very much.
But the question.
it might be possible. Yes. The reason why, yes, the question was for this slide with the woman's face with the landmarks, whether this face was attractive because it was a neonate face rather than a symmetric face. And I think that was how I understood you. Yes, and the reason why this can be dissociated is that in these tests, the pictures have been scanned into computers, so you can manipulate the level of asymmetry in the picture on the computer. It's the same face, but you can move features in the computer. So you're not changing the degree of neoteny, as you say, by this manipulation. I'll repeat it, if you just tell me the question. Why you don't think it addresses...
As I understand it, it doesn't matter if the face is computer-generated or the example of a living face, the same issue applies. It seems clear that one of the standards by which the beauty of women is judged is how young it looks.
Yes. Yes, but I fully agree with that. But that's why I say that when you have this photograph of this particular person scanned in the computer, what you are doing in this experiment is that you're manipulating the level of asymmetry. You're moving the mouth a little bit to the left, for example. But you still have the same face with the same overall general neonate features, I think.
If you look at juvenile chimpanzees and adult chimpanzees, the juvenile chimpanzee has a more symmetric face.
Yes.
And also, it's no coincidence, the juvenile chimpanzee has a face very close to ours,
yes.
And the adult chimpanzee has a face miles away from
ours. Yes. No, but as I said, what these studies have shown is that the faces that are close to the average in the population are attractive, but if you manipulate the asymmetry in these faces, you get an effect of that as well. So I'm not saying that symmetry is the only feature of these faces that's attractive, if that's how you understand what I've said. I'm saying that there is these two independent effects, and of course there might be many other effects, who knows? But that's what has come out of these studies.
I think the question of the average face depends a lot on, and the answer to the question you put depends a lot on whether you say, are these faces beautiful or are they attractive? Mm. And the average faces that people agree are beautiful. But if in fact it's distorted by using a caricature of the answer, in fact they then become more attractive.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably some of the studies should be done on those average faces. The answer they got was that they do indeed look beautiful,
mm.
But they don't actually, they look like stars, don't
they? Yes, but perhaps I didn't express myself sufficiently clearly concerning this issue, but what has been done in these two particular studies where these facial features have been manipulated is that people have looked, have rated them in terms of attractiveness, not whether or not they were beautiful. So it was more questions like, I can't remember by heart, but something like, which one of these would you like to cohabit with, or something like that. I don't know how they ask these questions in the States, but something like that. Well, I can. You don't have to. Well, okay. I think we just start from one end. I can't remember who was first. Yes, as you say, there is also some directional. Well, the question was whether these dermatoglyphic asymmetries in children born by mothers that had consumed different amounts of alcohol were due to lower birth weights of these children. And for the fetal alcohol syndrome, it's known that the birth weight is lower than. Children born by mothers that have not consumed similar amounts of alcohol. As you said, there is, if you look at dermatoglyphic asymmetry, there's lots of directional components also. But these directional components have been cancelled out in the calculations. So these are pure fluctuating asymmetries that were estimated in the study. I don't know the answer to that question. I think it if we just take them from. Yes, as I tried to indicate, the left-handedness or handedness is associated with a wide range of features, ranging from immune deficiency problems to lower birth weight. So there's a number of different features that one might expect would be common in individuals that are, on average, asymmetric. So it's not necessarily the case that this elevated level of asymmetry is directly coupled with the handedness. It could be, of course, that you have because of the lower birth weight, because of immune deficiency problems, because of other problems, these individuals are more perturbed during ontogeny, and for that reason, they develop high levels of asymmetry. Yes, I know that this is disputed, but what I try to show in this slide by summarizing all these different features that have been emphasized as being related to handedness, I think on average one would say that this is certainly pushing the balance in favor of right-handed as compared to left-handed people.
Sorry, could I specifically take up this point? Because I do not believe any of the things you put up about the decreased fitness of left-handed.
Okay.
As far as immune deficit is concerned, there's a large meta-analysis which shows no difference at all between right and left-handed. As far as birth weight differences are concerned, the current meta-analysis shows no difference overall. Or it's such a tiny one, no consequence at all. Okay. If you take menopause and menarche, I did a before your talk, I did a literature search on Index Medicus.
Yes.
There are three studies. One finds left hand is earlier in menopause, one finds it later, and the third finds it's different.
Okay.
So I don't believe that one.
Okay.
As far as current study is concerned, it's not a matter of contention. It's frankly wrong, and it depends on a simple statistical answer. If you look at people who are dead, as Corrin did, and ask what age they died at, whether they are right or left-handed, you find that the left-handers have an earlier age at death than the right-handers.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with that is it doesn't look at living people. If you look at right-handers in general in the population who are alive,
yes,
they are also older than left-handers. The reason is that there's secular trends whereby left-handedness is now much more common than it was. People declare themselves to be left-handedness now. They had it trained out from earlier on in this century. If you take that into account, the whole thing falls to this. It's a classic epidemiological artifact which the epidemiologists use to teach on errors of interpretation of these data.
Okay.
And so I do not believe any of the major claims he said that there is a decreased fitness of left-handedness. What is quite clear is that left-handedness is a cultural symbolism. Left is bad, right is good. It comes right through all anthropological systems to look at. And I think what we're often seeing here is a simple assumption that left-handedness must be bad, they must die, etc. I do not know the basic data that shows they're less fit. Sorry, put it bluntly.
Yeah, no, but that's fine. If we assume that this handedness is maintained by frequency-dependent selection, what?
That's what you're trying to prove. You can't assume that. Why might it be maintained by a balanced polymorphism? There are plenty of other genetic mechanisms.
Yes.
Polymorphism.
Yes. That's true.
Frequency-dependent is relatively rare. It might be true. I don't doubt that they
from. But what we do know is that, as I said, on average, there's an overrepresentation of left-handers among the male part of the population.
There's an overrepresentation of many conditions in males.
Yes.
And there are many explanations for that.
I know.
Frequency-dependent selection is not the only.
I know. But there's also studies showing that twins have a higher probability of being left-handed people.
They're contentious as well. The vast majority of studies have been that use different selection criteria in twins and singles.
Okay.
That was a long while ago. The new study is some find it, some don't.
Okay. Well, that was my last answer.
You're right. It's a very interesting question why left-handed exists. Frequency-dependent selection may be part of the story, but I'm not. Whether left hands have a fitness is a tiny separate question. I don't think we're able to show it.
Okay. I think we came from over here. It was you.
If symmetry is as important as your data suggested, is it not public that there are more right hands than left hands anyway? Wouldn't we expect the mean to be some form of ambidextrous with both dominant right hands?
I would agree on that, sure. But as I started out by saying, and by talking about this apparent parcel, I'm not sure about the answer, but what we could show in this study of these people involved in these different kinds of sports was that indeed there is an increase in left-handedness if you look at these interacting sports. So in indicating that there is an advantage in that particular context. Just continue.
More recently, I'm interested in following
Yes, I agree with you to some extent. For example, I know for many kinds of fighting sports that are practiced in the East, what people are doing when they're training is that they are strongly encouraged not to use the right hand if they want that in particular kinds of interactions. They're always encouraged to use the opposite limb of what they intend to do, and in that way you can create people who are very good at performing with either limb in these particular contexts. And of course that gives them perhaps an advantage in these sports.
As a left-hander, perhaps I can take you back to other forms of symmetry. Have there been studies of the symmetry maintenance through life, so we know how it varies with age? I'm interested in that because it would also be interesting to see measures of symmetry against age and death, which we can correct them for variations of age. Mm.
So you are asking this specifically for humans, or what? Yes. There are some studies of asymmetry in relation to age, and one recent study by John Manning was where he measured children of different ages, and there was a continuous decline in asymmetry as they grew older. The first age class he measured was 1 year old children, and for children aged 18 years there was the lowest level of asymmetry. There was a small blip on this curve, and that was around age 13, 14.
When we talk of some occupations
That might be the case. I don't know. There is no data on grown-ups and how their asymmetries look like with respect to age. So I can't tell you.
Talking about the age of death, right?
No.
In a paper that you did with Edward Womankowski that you didn't talk about today, you showed that sexually selected traits have higher fluctuating asymmetry than traits that aren't sexually selected. But on the other hand, sexual selection often favors symmetry. Can you talk about ways to resolve that apparent paradox?
Yes. I don't know if you could hear it up there, but the question was what's usually seen when you study morphological characters is that secondary sexual characters are more asymmetric than ordinary morphological characters that are not subject to sexual selection. But a number of studies have also indicated that there is mate preferences for symmetric individuals. So how can we get a higher frequency of asymmetry if there's this strong selection for symmetry in this sexual selection context? The hypothesis that we put forward to explain this phenomenon is that if you impose strong directional selection on particular characters, that reduces the ability of individuals to control this development. Many secondary sexual characters are known or presumed to be indicators of a body condition. And if you are controlling the development of a particular character very closely, then you will not be able to channel excess resources into development of a more extreme character if you have an abundance of resources available. This is not just a hypothesis, because a number of different selection experiments in the lab have shown that if you impose directional selection on ordinary morphological characters, you also increase the level of asymmetry. Whereas if you impose stabilizing selection on the similar kinds of traits, you reduce the asymmetry. I think there's you. I couldn't really hear what you're saying.
Yes.
left-handedness is associated, or handedness is associated with the lateralization of brain activity. Left-handed people are less lateralized as compared to right-handed people. I indicated in one of these slides that elevated levels of developmental instability in humans goes with the learning problems, learning problems in context where people have to learn different features. And if you extend that to this particular problem with handedness, where left-handers on average are more asymmetric or have more phenodeviance, you might argue that that could indicate there would be more of these problems among left-handers. But I don't know the answer, if it has been studied. Pardon? Well, the only advantage that I have come up with is this advantage in sports, and it's up to you if you want to extend that to other kinds of interactions among individuals. But perhaps it's not far-fetched that you might get similar kinds of effects.
Well, you brought up already the lateralization of the brain. Actually, isn't handedness mostly a marker for that? And that speech, for instance, it would be hard to say we're left speakers or right speakers. So the cultural explanation cannot be invoked, I would think. That is a function which is given as right or left from birth, would we say, and that therefore lateralization is actually an inbuilt characteristic rather than a trained in one, contrary to some of the other comments. How about yourself?
Okay. As I said, this German medical doctor, he actually went to Paris and he took his ruler out and started measuring the limbs of the statue. So he had the data, which are included in this paper. These individuals here are quite symmetric, but there you can see this one is slightly longer than this one. But if you go out and measure a number of individuals, you can find individuals that differ by 3, 4, 5 centimeters between sides. So you don't need calipers to tell that they are asymmetric. What is, I think, characteristic of many organisms in sexual displays is that it looks as if they are displaying these features to individuals of the opposite sex. What, for example, this particular bird species does is that the male is flying with the tail feather spread out in front of the female who is following him. Another example is the stickleback, where the males attempt to attract the female by making a zigzag display. So he's making rather rigid, perhaps difficult movements a number of different times, which might reveal differences in muscle size or skeletal size between the sides.
lots of these stereotyped kinds of behavior shown during during courtship might actually be ways in which you can tell something about how these organisms look like under the skin. Well, as I said, this German medical doctor, he didn't find her particularly attractive. Could you please mention these negative results? I can't remember any particular studies. There's a number of studies now where people have made experiments to test if when you increase the level of asymmetry, for example, in feathers, does that affect how birds fly? It does. That's the only experiments that have addressed this question particularly. I'm not aware of any studies showing a positive relationship between performance and asymmetry, for example. Or
well, the German sort of have an asymmetrically large right arm, and even that performance.
Yes, but when you're talking about these asymmetries, that's not the fluctuating asymmetries. That's directional asymmetries. It's well known that right-handed people have a number of different muscles that are larger on the right than the left side, but they're always larger on the right side. So it's something completely different.
I think you're being also very selective in your memory. There are
examples that you know. No, I think since you know them, you should just tell us and not insinuate that I'm hiding information, because I'm certainly not. Yes. Okay, but that I was thinking of this in terms of performance in how animals move and so on. I'm fully aware of the fact that in this literature on, for example, on homozygosity or inbreeding, there are different kinds of results. I've actually reviewed this literature, and the problem is that in many of these studies, people make rather small experiments, or it's not experiments, but there's small studies where they reject the null hypothesis. But because of the sample sizes, they can't accept the null hypothesis either, because the power of the statistical test is generally very low. And the way around these problems is to make meta-analyses. And I've been doing this, for example, in relation to homozygosity and in relation to inbreeding, and indeed there is an overall effect of these relationships. When you have elevated homozygosity, you have elevated developmental instability, and the same applies to inbreeding. But you get, if you look at the significance levels, you get a wrong impression, because you are evaluating these results without considering the power of the statistical tests.
Well, the other thing, of course, we can argue about that.
No way.
The other thing that bothers me about a number of studies is that when you look at the symmetry, if your hypothesis is that the overall quality of the alternate will affect the amount of the symmetry, then you would predict that the symmetry is a trait.
No.
When people have looked at the correlation between the characters, you do not find the symmetry of the characters.
Exactly. I've also reviewed that literature, and you on average, don't find strong positive correlations. And this is perhaps not so surprising because different traits develop at different times during this ontogenetic process. So if different external factors influence individuals and how they are they're undergoing morphogenesis at different times, and we know from embryology that different traits are sensitive to these external effects in different time windows, you would not necessarily expect this positive correlation. But what studies have shown is that if you go out and measure a range of different morphological characters, if you add up the asymmetries and more characters, you generally find stronger relationships with the various measures of performance, mating success or fecundity or whatever, implying that there is some information in these asymmetries, in these different traits. So by adding up this information, you get a stronger response on in the variable in which you're interested.
Okay.
Well, I'm immensely grateful to Helena Cronin for asking me to chair this next session and to introduce David Haig, who's one of these frightfully clever people who has this astonishing intelligence and who is working and is interested in a really vital and exciting topical area, the area of genomic imprinting. David comes from Australia, from Macquarie University, and then he went subsequently after leaving Australia to St. John's, Oxford, where he was a research fellow, and he's currently at Harvard in the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology, and he's going to talk about genetic conflicts in human pregnancy. David.
First of all, can you hear me now? Is that a yes? Good, good. Well, my topic today is going to be about pregnancy, and specifically pregnancy in humans. And I have always found pregnancy rather unusual as an evolutionary biologist. We are all brought up with the, you know, the immaculate design achieved by natural selection. The hand, even my hand, is a wonderful implement for doing all sorts of things, even my left hand, let alone my right hand. The eye is an immensely effective device for seeing things. And so one should expect that pregnancy, which after all is so essential to reproductive success and the transmission of genes to future generations, should be an equally effective and efficient process. However, we all know that many women have all sorts of problems and difficulties during pregnancy, swelling of the legs, a tendency to varicose veins, all sorts of problems. Why should this be so? If natural selection is so efficient at producing wonderful cases of adaptation, why do women have so many problems during pregnancy? Now, as an evolutionary biologist, when I see things that don't seem to be particularly good ideas, to be inefficient, one of the things that I look for is some form of evolutionary conflict. A possible source of inefficiency can always be that different entities, in this case, different genes, have different goals, are being selected for different sorts of outcomes, and the different kinds of selections tend to clash and cancel each other out. We're all aware of situations where conflicts can result in outcomes which are not particularly efficient or good for either of the conflicting parties. So one possibility which I'm going to explore of some of the problems that occur during pregnancy is that there are these evolutionary genetic conflicts. And so my talk will be specifically focusing on what I'm calling genetic conflicts. So these are non-conscious conflicts. And what I mean by a conflict just is that you can have natural selection favouring a gene, for instance, to increase maternal blood pressure if that gene is expressed in the offspring during pregnancy. And you can have counteracting adaptations in the mother to reduce her blood pressure. And so natural selection in this case is acting in two different directions, and the effects tend to cancel each other out. Now, to start off, I'd like to give you a little bit of an introduction to what I mean by a genetic conflict. And I'd just like you to consider the effect, I'm calling it a mutation here, but I'm just wanting you to consider the effect of a gene that causes a fetus to receive extra maternal resources during pregnancy. This is just the gene that has the effect that the fetus gets extra food from its mother's bloodstream. And such a gene has two kinds of effects relative to fitness. The first of these is that the fetus has more resources to enhance its own survival. We know from the old literature that infants that were born a little bit heavier than the average had higher probability of survival than infants with the average birth weight. And infants that were born with lower than average birth weight had greatly depressed survival. And in large part in the sense, so what I'm suggesting here is, first of all, that birth weight, small differences in weight at birth, may have had actually rather important implications for whether an infant survived the period of high infant mortality. We should note, of course, here that during the course of this century with modern obstetrics and medicine, these small differences in birth weights have largely been eliminated as being of selective importance. And infants who are have a little bit lower birth weight than average have very, very high chances of survival. In fact, they have the advantages probably of coming out a little bit easier than their heavier brothers and sisters. So transfer of extra nutrients to the fetus has benefits to that fetus, but the consequence is that the mother has less resources available for other purposes. A mother, if she is tired during pregnancy, is less able to care for older children that she has, who can be neglected. She's less able to stop them getting into accidents and getting into trouble. A mother, and now I would like you to think of many mothers during human evolution who are living in environments where there is periodic food shortage and food might be in short supply. If the energetic demands of the pregnancy were very heavy, it might take the mother a longer time to recover sufficiently to become fertile again and have another child. And all of these costs to the mother in terms of fitness can be expressed as there's an advantage to the current child, and ultimately the other costs to the mother reduce her chances of reproductive success through other offspring. So that there are indirect costs to other offspring. Either already existing older children who are getting less care because of the energy that the mother has to commit to the current pregnancy, or future offspring who she is less likely to produce because of the demands of the current pregnancy. Now, so far, I've just said that there are direct benefits to one offspring and indirect cost to other offspring of the mother. And so it isn't obvious whether natural selection will favour this gene that increases nutrient transfer, because the gene has costs and benefits. And whether such a gene would increase in frequency will depend upon how those costs and benefits are weighted against each other. Now, so far, I have said nothing at all about where this gene is expressed. It could be a gene expressed in the mother, which increases nutrient transfer to the fetus, or it could be a gene expressed in the fetus, which increases its demands. But the important point is that the costs and benefits will be weighted differently in those two situations, and this is the source of the evolutionary conflict. So what I'd like you to think about here, I'm now looking at the probability that the gene, this hypothetical gene we're imagining, which just increases nutrient transfer, is present in the fetus who gains the benefit, or in another offspring of the mother, one of its maternal siblings, who experiences an indirect cost. Now, from the point of view of a gene in the mother, it's got a 50% chance of being in the fetus that gains the benefit, but it's got the same probability of being present in each one of the mother's other offspring. So from the point of view of maternal genes, they are impartial with respect to all of the mother's offspring. And so they will favour a level of allocation that maximises that mother's lifetime reproductive success. And if maximising her expected reproduction means investing a little bit less in the current child to have more available for future children, that will be favoured by selection. However, things are different when we consider a gene with a similar effect of increasing nutrient transfer. But in this occasion, the gene is expressed in the fetus. So the gene now has a probability of one. We'll now consider a gene that the fetus has got from its mother causing extra nutrients to come to the fetus. It's got a probability of one. It's definitely present in the offspring that's gaining the benefit, but it's only got a 50% probability of being present in each of the mother's other offspring. So the consequence of this is that genes expressed in the fetus will evolve, if you like, to show favoritism towards their own offspring rather than towards the siblings. And in the theory of parent-offspring conflict, this is thought to be the underlying source of sibling rivalry, which we're all familiar with, that siblings can often squabble among themselves to get greater share of resources. Well, in this case, the sibling rivalry is being expressed through the mother. Greater demands that the fetus makes on its mother mean less resources that might be available at some time in the future to other offspring of the mother. So we would expect, just by this simple model, that we would have selection of genes expressed in the fetus to make greater demands on the mother during a pregnancy than genes expressed in the mother are selected to supply. Now, I've also pointed out I've made an interesting note here, that I was talking here about a maternal gene. Let's consider a paternal gene, a gene that the fetus gets from its father. Such a gene is also definitely present in the offspring that is gaining the direct benefit, but it has a probability of being present in other offspring of that mother that gets discounted by the chances that the mother will change partners between successive offsprings. So here, F is the probability that both offspring have the same father. If this probability was 1, the paternal gene would have a probability of half of being present in the mother's other offspring, which was the same as for a maternal gene in the fetus. However, in most mammals that we know anything about, including humans, there is not every woman has all of her children by the same man. For instance, husbands, partners can often die, and a woman takes another partner. Divorces occur. There are extramarital affairs. It could be for all sorts of reasons, but it will generally be the case that if you look at the genes in a fetus, its maternal genes are more likely to be present in its mother's other offspring than are the paternal genes in the same fetus and embryo. And the consequence of this is that one would predict that there is also a genetic conflict going on within individual cells of the fetus between its maternal and paternal genes, with its paternal genes actually making heavier demands on the mother than are the fetus's maternal genes. It's what you might expect. After all, the maternal component of the fetus is related to its mother, whereas the paternal component is a genetic outsider. So we're led to a series of predictions. The different genes that are involved in the maternal-fetal interaction can be arranged in order of increasing order of preference for investment in the current embryo, with genes expressed in the embryo favouring comparatively lower levels of investment. I should emphasise here that, of course, the mother maternal genes really have been selected to produce healthy offspring, because that is the only way that they get transmitted into the future. But there's still So mothers are not trying to limit food supply altogether to the fetus. They're just trying to limit the amount that it gets to a level that is perfectly adequate for fetal survival, but which doesn't drain the mother too far. Then we have maternal genes expressed in the fetus would favour higher levels of investment, and last of all, paternal genes in the fetus favouring the highest level of investment. Now, for most of the talk, I'm going to ignore these potential internal conflicts within the fetus between maternal and paternal genes. And I will express the conflict as if it's just the conflict between genes in the mother and genes in the fetus. But first of all, I'd like to show you some of the very, very elegant evidence that shows, in fact, that maternal and paternal genes are doing different things during fetal development. Now, in traditional genetics, going back to Mendel, you know, a gene is a gene. It doesn't matter whether you get a gene from your mother or a father, it does the same thing. And it's only recently that we've come to discover that this assumption is not always correct, and that a gene can do different things depending on what parent it came from. And so what I'm going to talk about now is some very, very elegant work that was done largely in Cambridge in the work of Azim Sarani, and the very, very delicate manipulations I'll be talking about were done by his assistant, Sheila Barton. Now, they were working with mouse eggs, so this is looking at mouse development now, that had been fertilized in vitro. And there is a period of time after the sperm enters the egg cell before the two nuclei fuse. This period of time is some number of hours. And the two nuclei, the sperm nucleus and the egg nucleus, look different. So if you have a very, very, very fine pair of hands, you can go in with a pipette and you can suck out the egg nucleus from one cell, from one fertilized egg, and you can do a control experiment and replace it with an egg nucleus from another fertilized egg. So you've just substituted one nucleus for the other. You can then take that embryo, wait till the nuclei fuse, and implant it in a host mother, and they give birth to a perfectly normal mouse. So we're looking now here, let's get this right, at mouse embryos at day 10 of development. And this is one of these control embryos. This is an embryo which has just had its egg nucleus from one egg substituted with an egg nucleus from another egg. And so these embryos develop normally, they come to term. And this shows that this experimental manipulation of sucking out nuclei and replacing them with other nuclei is quite compatible with development being normal. And just pointing out what you're looking at here, this is the embryo itself at day 10 of development, and then this is its placental tissues. The placenta is derived from the fertilized egg and is, if you like, the feeding structure, the feeding organ of the embryo. However, the really interesting experiments to do are, suppose you take two fertilized eggs before the nuclei fused. You can produce an embryo with two mothers. You can take out the sperm nucleus from one egg and replace it with an egg nucleus from the other egg. So now you've got a fertilized egg which has got two haploid genomes, but now they come from two females. So those two nuclei fuse together, you produce a diploid zygote, and under conventional genetics, it should have developed normally to term, but they fail to develop to term. Or you can do the reciprocal experiment, and you can take out the egg nucleus from one egg and replace it with a sperm nucleus from another egg. And so now you've got a fertilized egg with two sperm nuclei in it, and so when those nuclei fuse, you've produced an embryo with two fathers that doesn't have any maternal genes. Once again, under classical genetics, those embryos should have developed normally, but they don't. And that's what we're looking at here. These embryos are embryos that have two mothers, have only maternal genes. And in the absence of a paternal genome, you notice already at day 10 of development that the embryo is somewhat growth retarded. And the reason why it's growth retarded is that there's very, very poor development of this tissue here, which is called the trophoblast. And these embryos fail to come to term and abort. So these embryos show that the development of the placental tissue, the feeding tissue, the tissue that is tapping into the maternal bloodstream, is largely under control of the genes that the embryo gets from its father. And this is confirmed when you look at the reciprocal experiment. This is looking at, this is at day 10 of development, an embryo with two fathers without any genes from a mother. Notice that there's very, very poor development of the embryo. It's just sitting here in its amniotic sac. But there is massive development of the trophoblast. So if there are extra paternal genes, you actually get greater than normal development of the feeding structure. And we know that the same things happen in human placental development. There is a condition called a hydatidiform mole. It's just an old historical name. And basically this is a pregnancy where a woman starts, she believes she's pregnant. She often has severe nausea and morning sickness, can often develop high blood pressure in second trimester. When she comes in for ultrasound, she's got a large belly. There's no embryo to be found in the ultrasound. All there is a massively proliferating placenta. And these hydatidiform moles are like these mouse embryos. For some reason we don't quite understand, an egg has been fertilized, but then the maternal genes have been eliminated, and so there are only paternal genes present. And if there's no maternal genome restraining the growth of the placenta, also in humans you produce, it's hard to know what to call it. We'll call it a conceptus, which has a massive placenta without any embryonic development. So this is consistent with the general theory that the demands on the mother, the growth of the feeding structures, are largely under the control of the paternal genome. Okay, now I'm going to talk in more details about human pregnancy. So I'm going to introduce you to some of the anatomy of pregnancy in humans. One of the first interesting things to say is that the human embryo isn't actually located in the cavity of the uterus. It's actually burrowed into the wall of the uterus. And this is what's called interstitial implantation. The fertilized egg comes down the fallopian tube, and then about 7 days after ovulation, it burrows into the wall of the uterus and becomes completely surrounded by maternal tissues. It then starts to produce a hormone called human chorionic gonadotropin, which stops menstruation. Okay, since it's in this situation, if the lining of the uterus was shed, the embryo would be lost. So there's a placental hormone produced by this embryo that stops that process. And in this location, the embryo then forms its placenta, which taps into the maternal bloodstream and through which maternal blood flows. And so the embryo is directly getting its nutrition from the same blood supply as all of the organs of the mother. Now the reason I go through this detail is one might think that this is the most efficient, natural way for a pregnancy to occur. But in fact there is a great deal of variation among mammals in placental arrangements. Even if we're only to consider primates, which are our group of mammals. For instance, among lemurs, okay, they're primates from Madagascar. Lemurs don't have an invasive placenta or embryo at all. The lemur embryo just sits in the cavity of the uterus. It doesn't invade maternal tissues. It doesn't tap into the maternal blood supply. Rather, it is nourished by what used to be called, in the last century, uterine milk. There are a lot of glands in the lining of the uterus, and in a lemur, these maternal glands secrete nutrient substances into the uterus, which are then absorbed by the placenta of the lemur. And so I suspect that in a lemur pregnancy, where there is no invasion of maternal tissues, that the mother has much greater control over the food supply for the offspring than does a mother in a human pregnancy, where the embryo has tapped into her blood supply. The next slide I'm going to show you is just showing you the maternal vessels, which are called spiral arteries, which supply the outer layer of the uterus. This is a drawing actually from the 1930s, and it's a drawing of the endometrium of a rhesus monkey, but humans are fairly similar. So this is the lining of the uterus. This is one of these uterine glands, which in lemurs secrete the uterine milk. And then here is the maternal blood vessel, the so-called spiral artery, that brings blood to the lining of the endometrium, and it is these vessels that are tapped into by the placenta. And just notice the amazingly convoluted, coiled nature of those arteries. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on. Okay, once the... Well, let's go. So now we're going to be looking in greater detail at this zone of attachment between the mother and the fetus, the mother and the embryo. In this diagram, the maternal tissues, the wall of the womb, is stippled in dots, and placental tissues, which are derived from the fertilized egg, are an organ of the fetus, as shown in hatching. Now, the invasion of maternal tissues by the embryo is an irregular invasion, and so maternal and fetal cells become intimately intermingled. In the old days, this used to be called the no man's land, because it was difficult to sort out where the mother ended and the fetus began. However, the point I want to make here is that the invasion of the maternal vessels, the invasion of the wall of the uterus, is particularly concentrated along the spiral arteries. Placental cells move into the walls of those arteries, and the first thing that happens is that they destroy the muscular lining of the arterial walls, so that now the mother is unable to constrict those arteries and shut off the supply of blood. The placental cells then start to greatly expand the diameter of those arteries to increase the flow of blood, to reduce the resistance to blood flow of those vessels. So the placenta opens up a contact into the maternal blood supply. Maternal blood then flows into an internal cavity in the placenta called the intervillous space. Notice that this cavity is entirely lined by placental cells that are derived from the offspring. And it is in this cavity that nutrient exchange takes place. After passing through here, maternal blood then flows out through the uterine veins and returns to the heart. Notice also that the invasion of the maternal vessels is selective for the arteries, and there isn't any comparable invasion of the veins. So that during the invasion phase, which occurs during the early stages of pregnancy, during the first trimester, placental cells single out in particular the arteries that are bringing blood to this region. Inside this cavity, into the cavity project what are called the chorionic villi. These are highly branched tree-like structures which contain the fetal blood vessels. And so they have a massive surface area from which nutrients can be extracted from maternal blood and into which wastes can be excreted. The fetal circulation never mixes with maternal blood. Fetal blood comes from the fetal heart through the umbilical artery and then branches many, many times into the capillaries of these chorionic villi. Nutrient exchange takes place, and then the blood returns through the umbilical vein to the fetus. Now, there is a very important asymmetry here. Notice that now fetal cells have direct access to the mother's bloodstream. So cells of the placenta can release hormones into the mother's blood that can influence her metabolism. Okay, at distant sites in the mother's liver, cells of the mother's liver will be unable to tell whether a particular hormone is being produced by the mother or by the placenta. So maternal metabolism and physiology during pregnancy comes to a certain extent to be under joint control, under both the hormonal control of the mother and of the fetus. However, the mother doesn't have the same access to the fetal blood supply. Any maternal hormones that, if they're to influence fetal physiology, would have to cross across the cell membranes and cytoplasm of placental cells. So this gives the fetus a good deal of control over what substances get into its bloodstream that isn't available to the mother. Incidentally, it isn't only hormones and other substances that can be released into the mother's blood. We now know that in every human pregnancy, from about 5 weeks of the pregnancy, fetal cells can be found circulating in the mother's bloodstream. There's been a lot of effort into trying to separate these from the mother's blood, Because if you could do that, you could take a sample of blood from the mother's arm, separate out the fetal cells, and do your prenatal diagnosis on those cells without having to do amniocentesis or some invasive procedure. But nobody so far has asked, what are these cells doing circulating in the mother's body? And I think that is going to be an important area for future research. Okay. So just restating one of the points I made there, that the concept... Pardon me. That the conceptus, just a fancy word for the fetus and its placenta, has direct access to its mother's blood and can potentially manipulate maternal behavior by the release of hormones that mimic maternal signals. In the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about just three aspects where there's potential for conflict between maternal and fetal genes during pregnancy. The first of these is on whether or not to miscarry. And I will give you some evidence that perhaps the majority of all fertilized human eggs are lost at the first menstruation, so that there is potential for very, very strong selection here. For a fetal gene, if it can make itself be one of those successful embryos that gives rise to a successful pregnancy, it can greatly enhance the probability that that gene will be transmitted to the future. Whereas the cost for a mother, if a mother loses an embryo without even knowing that she's pregnant, she might become pregnant again the next month or the next month after that. All of the costs of raising childhood, almost all of them, come after that first month. So that losing one embryo early on is going to have very, very little impact at all for the mother's total lifetime reproductive success. Secondly, I will talk about potential conflicts over the nutrient content, the nutrient quality of maternal blood. Since the fetus has access to its mother's bloodstream, it can increase its food supply just by increasing the level of nutrients in its mother's blood. For instance, by increasing her blood sugar levels. And after all, as I've said, the fetus now is able to secrete hormones into the mother's body that can potentially have those sort of effects. And finally, I'll talk about potential conflicts over the volume of blood that reaches the placenta. If the fetus can increase the share of the total maternal output of the heart that goes to the placenta, it's also going to increase its food supply. Let's consider the first of these first, and I'll show you some of the evidence that there is a very, very high level of early mortality in human embryos. This is data from the early 1980s, English data. It's from a group of women from their mid-20s to their early 30s who are attempting to conceive, having regular sexual intercourse and not practicing contraception. In this study, there was evidence for 207 cycles in the course of the study. And there was evidence that ovulation had occurred in 198 of those cycles. So in 96% of all the cycles, there was evidence that an egg had been released. Of the 198 eggs released, 118 of these were detected as what I will call chemical pregnancies. Now in this case, what I mean by a chemical pregnancy, these were using the most sensitive techniques available at the time to look for that hormone, human chorionic gonadotropin, that I talked about. And so they were looking for its presence in the mother's blood. If it was detected in the mother's blood, that was evidence that the embryo had implanted. So this is looking at about day 7 after ovulation. They're looking for evidence, day 7 to 10 to 14, looking for evidence of chorionic gonadotropin. And so they had evidence of these 198 eggs that were released. They had evidence that in 118 of the cases, an implantation had occurred. There may have been even more embryos produced, which were lost even before this stage. Now these chemical pregnancies correspond to a situation where the woman wouldn't even know that she was pregnant. Okay, so this is before the woman would know she was pregnant. And this is what I mean by a clinical pregnancy. A clinical pregnancy is a pregnancy that would have been diagnosed in the normal course of events by a woman going to her doctor who told her she was present, or by having a positive home pregnancy test. So there were 51 clinical pregnancies. However, there had been 118 chemical pregnancies. So over in this study, over 50% of the embryos that they had evidence for being for implanting were lost before the mother would even have known that she was pregnant. Then, of the 51 clinical pregnancies, only 45 of them came to term as successful pregnancies. So there was about a 10% about a 10% loss of clinically recognized pregnancies that miscarried in first trimester. And that is a very, very typical figure, that once a woman is aware that she's pregnant, she's got about a 10 to 15% probability of miscarriage. And the majority of those miscarriages, there's evidence that there's something severely wrong with the fetus, and so the miscarriage, rather than something malfunctioning, in most cases seems to be some sort of quality control device. However, we know next to nothing about these other embryos that are being lost much earlier than that. Okay, so given this high early mortality, there would be great advantages for a fetal gene to increase its probability of being one of those minority of embryos that actually gave rise to a successful pregnancy. And for instance, suppose that this was a conception that occurred after a one-night stand. From the point of view of a paternal gene in that embryo, it might never get another chance of producing an embryo with that mother. So that the selection pressures are potentially very strong. And so we would expect there to be adaptations of the embryo to increase its probability of being one of the lucky ones that gives rise to a successful pregnancy. And precisely such adaptations exist. Now, to explain them, I'll need to introduce you to a bit of the endocrinology of of mammalian pregnancy. Now, as in everything to do with reproduction, it's very variable among mammals. So I'm telling you a simplified story. In many mammals, the corpus luteum is the structure that forms in the ovary after the egg is released. And this produces a hormone called progesterone. And progesterone acts on the uterus to maintain the pregnancy. And if you cut off the supply of progesterone, this will result in an abortion of the pregnancy. So RU486, the so-called abortion pill, is actually something that interferes with progesterone. So it blocks the effects of progesterone, which results in the abortion of the pregnancy, a miscarriage. Now, in many mammals, the corpus luteum produces progesterone in response to a hormone called luteinizing hormone, which is released from the anterior pituitary in the brain of the mother. So we have this simple procedure. The maternal pituitary releases luteinizing hormone, which acts on the corpus luteum to maintain the production of progesterone, which maintains the pregnancy. And so in a mouse, if you remove the corpus luteum at any stage during pregnancy, you cut off the supply of progesterone and the embryos will abort. The pregnancy will be aborted. Similarly, in a rabbit, if you remove the corpus luteum, well, there are multiple corpora lutea, as they call it in a rabbit, but if you remove all of this tissue, you cut off the supply of progesterone and the pregnancy aborts. In the rabbit, if you remove the mother's anterior pituitary, you cut off the supply of luteinizing hormone. So the corpus luteum now no longer responds by producing progesterone and the pregnancy aborts. Human embryos tap into this system at two levels. Early on during the pregnancy, when they are really small, the embryo is really small, it produces its own luteinizing hormone. This is the molecule chorionic gonadotropin that I've talked about. It is very, very similar to luteinizing hormone. It acts at the same sites in the corpus luteum to maintain the production of progesterone. And so the production of progesterone now has passed from maternal control, which he could shut off by shutting off luteinizing hormone. Now the conceptus is producing its own version of this molecule. And chorionic gonadotropin is the hormone that you look for in a home pregnancy kit. So when, I use them all the time, and the antibodies are looking for is actually the presence of chorionic gonadotropin in the mother's urine, and that is a product of the embryo. However, As the placenta becomes larger, it starts to produce progesterone. And by the seventh week of pregnancy, the placenta is producing sufficient progesterone to run the pregnancy all by itself. It's removed during pregnancy, removing the corpus luteum. If their ovaries were removed before about day 50, before the eighth week, removal of the ovary and the corpus luteum resulted in abortion because the pregnancy was still dependent on a maternal supply of progesterone. However, after about day 50, from the eighth week onward, the placenta is producing enough progesterone that even though a woman had her ovary removed, the pregnancy would continue to term. And so this particular hormonal mechanism is one that has also passed into the control of the conceptus, into the control of the embryo. This is just a little bit of genetics. You don't need to worry about it much, but this is a diagram of the particular region on human chromosome 19 where the genes for chorionic gonadotropin exist. There exists here one gene for luteinizing hormone. This is the maternal hormone that is produced in the mother's pituitary. And most mammals only have this one gene. However, in primates, this gene has been duplicated at least 6 times to produce the genes, to give the genes that produce chorionic gonadotropin. And so this gene is the maternal gene, which is expressed in the mother's pituitary, and these 6 genes are expressed in the placenta, which is a fetal tissue, but are secreted into the mother's bloodstream. And they're secreted into the mother's bloodstream in absolutely massive quantities. These units aren't strictly comparable, but they give the right sort of idea. The maximum level of luteinizing hormone in the mother's blood is 100 of these units at the time of ovulation. However, early in pregnancy, the small embryo is creating concentrations many much higher concentrations going into the mother's bloodstream. Okay. And this just is now giving you the pattern of the major placental hormones, some of which I'll talk about. The first one I've talked about is human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG. Oops, sorry. I hope that's well enough focused. Starting at the beginning of pregnancy, the embryo, the placenta, starts to produce massive amounts of this hormone. And then towards the end of first trimester, its levels drop and then are maintained at really high levels unto term when they drastically fall in the mother's blood after the placenta is delivered. The other placental hormones show a different pattern. And the ones I'm mentioning here are progesterone, estradiol and estrogen, and a hormone I'll say some more about called human placental lactogen. These ones, their production increases to term as the placenta becomes larger, so they reach very, very high levels at term, and then they also dramatically drop in the mother's bloodstream after delivery of the placenta. Now, the thing to point out about HCG here, human chorionic gonadotropin, is that it is only produced in high quantities at the beginning of pregnancy, which is when a miscarriage is going to occur, if it will occur, and before the placenta becomes a major source of progesterone. And an interesting epidemiological observation is that women who experience... I'll take one step back. Notice also that this high peak of chorionic gonadotropin production correlates with the times during pregnancy when the mother is experiencing nausea and vomiting, what is commonly called morning sickness. And so it's often been suspected that this hormone is responsible for those symptoms, and there is now beginning to be very good evidence that a particular subset of this hormone is actually responsible for those symptoms. And an interesting observation is that women who experience nausea during pregnancy are less likely to miscarry than women who don't. I should emphasize that if you don't experience nausea, there's still a very good chance that the pregnancy will be carried successfully. But on average, those symptoms are actually a good sign for a successful outcome to the pregnancy. Now, I think the placental hormones provide some of the best evidence for this conflict that I'm talking about. The function of a hormone is traditionally thought of to send a message. And so hormones send messages between different parts of the body in the non-pregnant state to communicate information between different cells. And one of the reasons why hormones took such a long time to be found is that they are found in very, very low dosages. Okay, because the communication between different cells of the same body, they're parts of the same body, there's no incentive for one cell to lie to another cell. The messages can be trusted. All you need to do is communicate the message in a whisper. However, things become very different for a placental hormone. I'm arguing that the placental hormone's function is to manipulate maternal physiology for benefit of the fetus. So the selection pressures are going to be quite different. Rather than having selection to make signals be sent as cheap as possible, you're going to evolve sales resistance. The placenta is selected to produce a little bit extra hormone to get a greater effect. The mother is selected not to be fooled and not to respond. So the placenta is selected to produce even more of the hormone. I think placental hormones are somewhat like the hormonal equivalent of junk mail. And I'll show you some interesting comparisons here. Here's the comparison I've already given you between human luteinizing hormone, a maternal hormone, and its placental equivalent. And as I showed, very, very much higher levels of this hormone being produced in the pregnant state by the placenta. But you can do a similar comparison. Human growth hormone has a placental version of itself called human placental lactogen, which I will talk about. And we have a similar massive difference in the levels in maternal blood. This is actually human placental lactogen, this placental hormone, is the most abundant hormone produced at any time during the human life cycle. It is estimated that between 1 to 3 grams a day of this hormone is being secreted into the mother's bloodstream at term. And this massive production of the hormone has been a real mystery to endocrinologists. If a hormone is produced in such massive quantities, it must be doing something very, very important. The only problem is that there have been children who have been born who have deletion of this gene, who don't produce any of that gene, and still the pregnancy goes to term. So we have this seeming paradox that a hormone is being produced in very, very high levels, but it's having rather minor effects. And I think this is only makes sense in terms of that process of sales resistance that I talked about. The hormone is being produced to just increase the nutrient levels by a little bit, but the mother is being selected not to respond. And so you have an escalation in hormone production. And similar comparisons can be done with progesterone. In the non-pregnant state, where the progesterone is being produced in the mother's body, relatively low levels. When the progesterone is being produced by the placenta and excreted into the mother's bloodstream at much higher levels. And similarly for estradiol. Estradiol, though it's produced in much higher quantities during pregnancy, is also not essential for a successful outcome to the pregnancy. There are genetic conditions where the placenta is only able to make tiny amounts of estrogen during the pregnancy, and yet they come to a successful term pregnancy. Okay, the second area I will talk about are potential conflicts over the nutrient content of maternal blood. And I could talk about almost any nutrient, but I will concentrate on the levels of sugars, of carbohydrates in the mother's blood. And maternal sugar metabolism is modified during pregnancy. The first of these is a somewhat odd observation at first sight. During the normal day, we maintain our blood sugar levels at a constant fasting level. And presumably that level of blood sugar is optimal for general physiological activities. However, early during pregnancy, fasting blood glucose levels in the mothers fall. And this isn't because the embryo is taking the glucose out of the mother's blood, because at the time the embryo is very, very small with very small demands. It is that the mother is actually reducing her blood sugar levels early in the pregnancy. And I would interpret this, since the fetus, the placenta, is tapped into the maternal bloodstream, the only way that the mother can ration the growth rate of that embryo is to reduce the level of glucose in her own blood. So to ration the embryo, she's got to starve her own tissues. However, as the pregnancy progresses, there are two other factors take hold that tend to cancel each other out. The first of these is that maternal sensitivity to insulin decreases as pregnancy progresses. This means that a mother has to produce more insulin to get her blood glucose levels to drop after a meal. As most of you will probably know, after you've eaten a meal, your blood glucose levels rise, and then the pancreas produces insulin to push those blood glucose levels down to the optimal regulated level. Now think about this from the point of view of the embryo. If the embryo can block that effect, when the mother has a meal, her blood glucose levels will go up higher and they will stay elevated longer, which gives the embryo a longer shot, gives it a greater proportion of that meal. And this effect is being caused by that placental hormone I talked about earlier, human placental lactogen. This is a placental hormone that, among its effects, is making the mother's body less sensitive to insulin. However, the mother's body is not powerless, and she normally fights back by increasing her own production of insulin. And so these two effects tend to cancel each other out. And so in most pregnancies, a mother is able to regulate her blood glucose levels. In a minority of pregnancies, about 2-3%, the mother is unable to produce enough insulin in response, and she develops a condition which is called gestational diabetes. She loses control of her blood sugar levels. They rise, but this is a diabetes that is cured at delivery, because as soon as the placenta is removed, the hormones that were causing the diabetes are also removed. Just briefly, here we have a very similar pattern to what I talked about before for chorionic gonadotropin. This is on a region of human chromosome 17. There is one gene which is present in all mammals that produces human growth hormone. This is a maternal hormone, also present in men, of course. And this gene in primates has been duplicated a number of times. And these four genes are expressed only in the placenta. These two produce human placental lactogen, which I've just been talking about. This gene produces another hormone called human placental growth hormone. We don't know much about it, but what we do know is at the end of pregnancy, all of the growth hormone in the mother's blood is coming from the placenta. She's not producing any more of it herself. So this is another hormonal system that has passed into fetal control. Okay, we'll now talk a little bit about potential conflict over the amount of blood reaching the placenta. This is a simplified diagram of the maternal circulation during pregnancy. Maternal blood leaving the left side of the heart circulates out to the maternal tissues, returns to the right side of the heart, is oxygenated in the lungs, and then is pumped back out to the tissues. In the implantation phase, the placenta punches a hole in the maternal circulation so that some of this blood circulation is siphoned off to flow through the intervillous space when nutrient exchange occurs. So the proportion of the mother's circulation that flows through the placenta is going to be determined by the relative resistance in this here, in the blood supply coming to the placenta, and I'm going to call this the utero-placental resistance, relative to the resistance in the rest of the mother's body, and I will call that the non-placental resistance. Just in equations, to prove that I'm a scientist. The fetal share of the mother's systemic blood supply is going to be determined by a simple ratio. The resistance, the non-placental resistance in the mother's circulation over the total resistance. And therefore, we would predict, we can make a number of predictions. First of all, in the blood supply coming to the uterus, that's the uterine placental resistance, we would suspect that the placental factors would attempt to decrease this resistance to increase the flow of blood, whereas maternal factors would tend to increase that resistance. And I'll just come back to that in a sec. In the rest of the mother's circulation, we would expect that placental factors would act to increase the resistance, and maternal factors would have the other effect, and they would attempt to decrease the resistance. We don't have a lot of evidence on what's happening here, but there is some circumstantial evidence. Early on during the pregnancy, when the placenta is small, the mother's non-placental resistance drops dramatically. And I interpret this as an adaptation of the mother to try and get some of that blood back, to direct it away from the placenta. And this drop in peripheral resistance can be, okay, it has a number of effects. One, it's associated with the tendency to develop varicose veins during pregnancy, and it's also associated, some pregnant women notice that they have hot hands during pregnancy. And this is because there's less resistance in the peripheral tissues, so more blood is rushing out to those tissues, and by the way, directing blood away from the placenta and the embryo. However, as the pregnancy progresses and the placenta becomes larger and larger, maternal blood pressure tends to increase, and about 10% of women, their blood pressure increases sufficiently for them to be described as having hypertension. And I'll talk. So my interpretation is that increases in maternal blood pressure are adaptations of the fetus to increase its nutrient supply and the flow of blood. Let's just return to this part of the table. You know, we would predict in evolutionary terms that maternal adaptations would try to increase the resistance in this circulation, whereas placental adaptations would attempt to decrease the resistance. And just come back to this figure. Okay, now look again at the maternal spiral arteries. What is happening here? Why are these arteries so convoluted? Well, one thing that the spiraling does, this artery is very, very long, and the longer the length of this vessel, the greater the resistance. Also, the more bends and turns and doubling backs on itself it does, the greater the resistance in the vessels. So I interpret the spiral arteries as a maternal adaptation to actually increase the resistance here and reduce the flow of blood. However, notice what the placenta does. The invasion of the placenta is directed at invading these vessels, destroying their ability to contract, and greatly expanding their diameter. And just a bit of fluid dynamics here. This is a bit of physics, but the point I'm wanting to make here is the flow rate is proportional to the fourth power of the radius of a vessel. And what that means is that small increases in the diameter of a vessel are going to greatly increase the flow of blood coming to the placenta. Okay, let's finish up with just two bits of absolutely fascinating information. I'm interpreting high blood pressure during pregnancy as an adaptation of the fetus to direct blood to itself at cost, ultimately, to some of the mother's other offspring. This is data from the French West Indies looking at the incidence of pregnancy-induced hypertension. And this is mapped against the duration of sexual cohabitation. So these are women who've just had a child and have been interviewed to find out how long they had been having sexual relations with the father of the child before the child was conceived. And so primigravity is just the fancy medical term for women having their first child. So this is this line here. Women who conceive their child at 4 months or less into a relationship with the father of the child had over 30% incidence of hypertension. Women who were having their first child 12 months or more after the commencement of a sexual relationship, the incidence of hypertension was only about 2 to 3%. It dropped tenfold in the course of about a year. However, what happens if a woman who has had a child by one man then has a latter child by a different man. What happens in the first child by that new partner? And so multigravida are women who've already had a child, and in their first child by a new partner, if it occurs early in the relationship, the incidence is way back up, even higher than for a first child, at almost 50%. But there's a similar decline in the incidence of hypertension as the relationship becomes more prolonged. Since I'm short for time, I'll just put that up as a fascinating data point. The next one I think is perhaps even more fascinating. I mentioned earlier that during pregnancy, fetal cells are circulating in the mother's body. And using an instrument called a cell sorter, using particular molecules, you can sort those cells into different categories, T cells, B cells, different things, and then you can attempt to diagnose genetical properties of those cells. So this is an amazing study, admittedly only a small study of 7 to 8 women. These women were all mothers who had sons. And so these mothers had already given birth to sons. A blood sample was taken from them. These technical terms just referred to the molecules that were used to sort. And the mother's blood was separated into B cells, T cells, and what are called stem cells. Stem cells are cells that are still capable of dividing. So these are cells that haven't committed themselves. They're just sitting in the body dividing. And what Diana Bianchi did in this study was she looked for the presence of Y chromosomes in the different cell populations. And if Y chromosomes were present, they can't have come from the mother, so they must be cells that were left over from her son. Looking in the B cell population, none of the 7 mothers where it would check had Y chromosomes in those cells. For T cells, one of the 7 mothers gave a positive signal for the presence of a Y chromosome. But the interesting observation was that 6 of the 8 mothers had Y chromosomes present in some of the stem cells circulating in their blood, which is showing that cells derived from the fetus were still persisting in their body. And the punchline is one of these women had given birth to her son 27 years previously. So it appears that there's a possibility that once a woman has become pregnant, she is carrying around somewhere in her body cells that are derived from that infant. We know nothing about what those cells are doing, whether they're doing anything in particular. But again, I think this is going to be a fascinating area of future research. Thank you very much. Questions, please. Chris.
Just on varicose veins. I wonder okay. If people might give them their name. Would that be possible?
Okay.
Chris and I, University of East London, on varicose veins and other problems during pregnancy, surely lemurs don't have those problems. Why is it that human females have these problems to such an extent?
Well, we know there's... Relative to human medical research, lemur medical research is rather limited. But one would not expect lemurs to have those particular problems because the mother still can limit the supply of blood to the uterus by constricting her vessels. There's no reason why that the only way that she can grab back some of that blood is by reducing her peripheral resistance. What's actually happening in that reduction of peripheral resistance is that early on in pregnancy, it seems that just all of the tone of the maternal vessels is greatly reduced and that they very much relax, and that is what then gives rise to the to some of these complications.
My question is why the difference? I mean, what, in other words, why the invasion of the human people?
Yeah. The only answer I can give to that is that mammals are very, very variable. Some have invasive placentas, some don't have invasive placentas. And people who've looked for patterns can't find any obvious patterns. But what we know about conflict situations is that if you've got a conflict of interest, sometimes you achieve a compromise, sometimes it breaks down into overt conflict, sometimes one side wins, sometimes another side wins, that there's a real historical component there. So the answer may be just something to do with the history of lemurs and the history of humans. Do you want me to do it? Or?
Okay.
Yes, please. P-values on testing what hypothesis?
On testing the data against your predictions, or put it another way, what type of data would you see as being able to reject the safety of the hypothesis?
I don't think that the science... The sort of story I'm telling you is, I think, a new way of looking at what's happening during pregnancy. In fact, the prediction of the mathematical prediction that there can be these evolutionary conflicts is almost a tautology of the Mendelian genetics. There is a real question, as I've said, that given that you've got different interests, we know from all sorts of human situations, sometimes they just don't break out into conflict and we have a compromise. Sometimes the conflict is overt, and so that the theory doesn't predict. But in terms of, I think that the hypothesis will rise and fall on what it explains, and I don't think that this statistical test of just adding up cases is the appropriate test. What we want to do is look at the details of the machinery. If you understand if you look in the detail at a carburetor, you can figure out what the carburetor is doing in the engine, and you don't need to do a statistical test on it. And that is my own particular preferred way of doing biology. Right up the back. Yeah. What I would say on that one is, I think when we're talking about Darwinian approaches to medicine, that at the moment all we're doing is trying to find new ways of looking at old problems and new questions to ask. And it would be very, very premature at this stage to start recommending actual clinical changes in clinical practice. And when and if those recommendations come, of course they've got to be subject to all of the standard tests that any new clinical innovation requires. Yes, in the blue dress? Yes.
There seems to be a tendency for some people to miscarry a number of babies and then having to carry the child. And that might square with an adaptation that you just need to do in the context. What I was wondering about was, if a mother at the time of birth has a blood cancer,
A lot of complicated questions that I have to think about a little. First of all, you asked about miscarriages. There are two sorts of miscarriages we've talked about. There are the very, very early ones before the mother knows she's pregnant, and we know little about them. There are then the ones where a woman recognizes she's pregnant and miscarries. Since from 10 to 15% of pregnancies in the normal population miscarry, there's also going to be a relatively, in a whole human population, there's going to be some proportion of women who just get unlucky twice in a row. If it's 10%, one in 100 women will have just by chance alone, two consecutive miscarriages. However, and so that could be anomaly, I think that most miscarriages are anomaly functioning adaptation. However, I should point out there are also women who can miscarry for some problem, either in, you know, maybe the genes coming from the husband, or there might be some uterine problem. And so those women repeatedly miscarry even when there's no problem with the embryo. So they are really quite rare, but they're a different sort of problem. We're not looking at an adaptation now. And one of the difficulties of definition is how many miscarriages in a row do you have to have before you decide that the woman has been unlucky and you decide that she has a problem which we need to try and treat by some sort of immunological procedure or transfusion. Now, I'm not quite sure where your question was directed from, but the attempts to increase the probability of a woman carrying a child to term by giving her immunizations of paternal antibodies or things like that, they're really trying to deal with that later sort of problem. And when an adaptation malfunctions, I don't think that's something that evolutionary theory has anything directly to say about.
Yes. I would just add, David, yes. If I may, that the slightest statistical evidence has to be survival of the transfusion of the thermal transfusion makes a slight difference to
lady here, first of all. First of all, we expect that there are evolutionary reasons for expecting that the sex ratio should be about equal numbers of males and females. Also, since we have an XY sex determining system and 50% of sperm carry X's and produce daughters and 50% of sperm carry Y's producing sons, we think the sex ratio should be 1:1. Now, there's a little bit of a puzzle there, because in fact there is a slight excess of males at birth. I think it's something like 104 males to every female at birth. And as you say, that if you look at miscarriages, they also are male biased. So as early as we can go and get chromosomes from embryos, you're getting more, and the male bias is becoming stronger and stronger. Okay, and we've got evidence going back to, you know, in the order of 5 to 10 weeks. So something happening before then, you have got to have an excess of males getting into the population. Now, what's possibly happening there is that, okay, and Robert Winston.
Down here.
Yeah. We do know that human male embryos now, for instance, actually are dividing already before they implant at a faster rate than female embryos. So if, and that all, we also have that evidence in mice, in pigs, and cattle. So if male embryos are dividing faster early on, they may be getting established in the endometrium more effectively, and they may be blocking that menstruation more effectively. So that may explain the excess of males that we're observing. Why they then have higher mortality later on? There are a number of possibilities. What is causing the faster growth rate of male embryos early? Well, they do have a Y chromosome, and a Y chromosome always comes from the father. So the faster growth rate early may be because of that presence of the Y chromosome. It's a difficult issue. What were you wanting to say?
Well, I don't want to be particularly technical, but you know that the male embryo actually is metabolizing sugars, both pyruvate and glucose, faster within 18 hours of the second. I just published that work recently.
Oh, where was that?
don't, of course, and what's so interesting is to know what the ratio of male to female embryos is at conception.
Yeah.
But certainly in the study that we've done, it was quite inadequate, was not one or two, were an excess of female embryos.
Excess of female embryos early.
Maybe an adaptation to bring up the, my idea, I wonder if this was an evolutionary adaptation to balance the sexes, because it is, you're right, it's extraordinary, it should be this very odd ratio at birth, which doesn't actually make sense unless there's some mechanism at the beginning of life.
There are two things I could say here. The prediction that the sex ratio should be roughly equal comes about because everybody's got a mother and a father. And so no matter what the sex ratio is, 50% of the genes the next generation are going to come from men and 50% from women. And so if there are lots and lots of women out there, and very, very few men, those men are going to be really, really reproductively successful. So for the mother, it would be to her advantage to produce sons because they get to have lots and lots of grandchildren with all those excess women. And so the stable point of that is about a one-to-one ratio. And I think I'll leave it there. There's a lot more I could say on that one. This fellow, and yes, shout at me. Okay, there are a lot of things that I could say on that. I'll talk just briefly about the two things that I talked in the talk. There is a correlation between birth weight and maternal resistance to insulin during the pregnancy. So the more resistant the mother is to the effect of insulin, the heavier her baby tends to be. Diabetic mothers, mothers who have pre-existing diabetes, this is in fact associated with very, very heavy babies and with real problems for delivery that are both for the mother and the infant. However, in the case of gestational diabetes, that is somewhat less clear. But there is an evidence that higher maternal glucose levels are then associated, as one might expect, with heavier birth weights. In the case of hypertension during pregnancy, it's a little more complicated. And in particular here, though about 10% of women develop hypertension, and there is some evidence that women with higher blood pressure in that group have somewhat heavier babies. It's a really difficult issue because there's a second factor coming in there, that there is a very severe condition in pregnancy called preeclampsia, which is associated with high blood pressure and is associated with very, very severe medical complications for the mother. Those mothers have very, very high blood pressure and they tend to have very light babies. So the high blood pressure seems to be correlated with a low birth weight. But we know when we look at the placentas of those babies with the low birth weight, they have had a problem in the invasion phase in the modification of the maternal arteries. So they have a poor food supply. And that poor food supply was established in first trimester a long time before the symptoms of high blood pressure kicked in. So my interpretation is what's happening here is, this is a baby that is being starved. It doesn't become a critical issue until third trimester, towards the end of pregnancy, when it starts to need a lot of food. It's not getting enough food, and so it takes drastic and high-risk action to increase its flow of blood by putting factors into its mother's bloodstream that greatly push up her blood supply. So the elevation of maternal blood supply is, I'm interpreting, is an adaptation for a compromised fetus. So this is the sort of thing that George Williams talks a lot about. You know, when you're looking at a disease condition, you've got to separate out what are the causes of the disease, what are the responses to it, etc. So I think there are a whole series of interesting questions there. And I'll leave it there and we can talk a bit about it later.
Yes, you started off with the assumption that the chiefess has the interest of getting the greater amount of resources and the mother has the corresponding interest of limiting that. But there's a limit to that in the chiefess's own interest as well, which is particularly in species like human species where there's only one chiefess in pregnancy. There may be some species differences there. Actually, if the chiefess were able to increase its resources and society, for example, will bring case of that, actually its own chances of mortality increase, and so do the chances of the mother's mortality. So would there not be differences in the way these things work between one single piece of pregnancy species and others?
Yes, there are some differences, and I'm just starting to think about litters. And you are, and somebody always makes that basic point. The assumption that I'm making actually here is, if we're mapping here a benefit to cost function, and this is the amount of nutrients that the fetus is getting, and you're quite right that there are limits to what is good for a fetus. If it gets too large, it's going to have difficulties being delivered. If the mother becomes too exhausted, a very sick mother is no good for looking after that child after birth. And so we would expect that the relationship between fetal nutrition and fetal survival, the benefit of the nutrients, to show some sort of hump-shaped distribution of this sort. But we would expect the cost to the mother to being a steadily increasing level. And so I do concede that very, very high levels of investment are not in fetal interest. But we do have a conflict here. I won't go into the details of the genetics, but notice that the level of investment, the fetal share of nutrients that maximises the benefit to the fetus occurs here. But the level that maximises the difference between the benefit and the cost is occurring at some other point down here. And as long as you make these two simple assumptions, that you've got some sort of hump-shaped benefit function and a rising cost function, it is always going to be the case that the level that is optimal, this is sort of straight economics, that is optimal for fetal genes or that is favoured by genes in the fetus is going to be greater than the level that is favoured by genes in the mother. Jeffrey.
As a follow-up to this question about litters, fetal genes can do really well if they grow two bodies instead of one. So is there any evidence that the splitting rates are higher for one-night stands, say, than for long cohabitation?
Well, that's in terms of monozygotic twins. Monozygotic twins have all sorts of health problems. And depending on the form, and so though it might be possible that by an embryo dividing itself into two or to three or to four or to five, you know, you're getting four or five copies of yourself. But if all of them die at birth, there's no advantage. And we don't know, in the course of human evolution, what the mortality rates were like for twins, for example. And it may well have not been in the embryo's interest to divide like that. But that sort of polyembryony is relatively uncommon, and it's an interesting question to ask why. Maybe it is just because perhaps at that early stage, let's leave that. There are some interesting examples, and this is just a little bit about litters. Most organisms that produce litters have these two-horned uteri. If you've ever dissected a pregnant rat, the embryos are distributed in separate little chambers all the way down the uterine horns. Now, my interpretation of this is actually an adaptation to keep the kids apart in the uterus and to stop them squabbling amongst themselves. They're all kept apart. Now, there are a number of situations in which, and this is a real issue. There is, for instance, the American pronghorn antelope has two embryos implanted in each uterine horn. Then one of them, the one that's closer to the cervix, produces a specialized structure that grows up the uterine horn and stabs its brother and sister and kills it. And that happens in every pronghorn pregnancy. So sibling rivalry in the uterus is a potential problem. And so there are real problems if, like humans, where you've got a uterus where you've got a uterus, I'm now talking about dizygotic twins, where you've got a uterus that is designed for carrying one, for having multiple embryos there. And there are two groups of animals that I know of where the ancestors have a simplex uterus like that and produce a single young, and then for ecological reasons, they've started to produce more than one young. And one of the cases is the marmosets. They're small little monkeys. They always have twins, and their placentas fuse in utero, and they exchange blood between the two. They even exchange germ cells. You can find cells from one twin in the gonads of the other one. And so this is an interesting thing that can happen. And this is associated with some medical problems that marmosets have. They're particularly vulnerable to viral diseases. And I won't go into the details here. Another interesting case where the ancestors had singletons and some individuals have a litter are the armadillos. They have a simplex uterus. But the ones who produce litters, well, not all of them, but some of the ones that produce litters produce identical octuplets or identical quadruplets, all from a single egg. So in that case, all the embryos inside are genetically the same, so they wouldn't fight anyway. And it may be, in fact, that in a certain sense, that sort of twinning procedure in armadillos is an adaptation to having a twin, having a litter in a uterus that is only designed for having singletons. Let's do this one, this one. How's the time going? Yes.
The example we've given all illustrate adaptation to the preventable people. Yeah. There's a classical one, which is very aggressive at first, and that's the ORH problem.
Yeah.
Where cells go into the people's blood and can cause damage and even death to the people. How do you think of that in evolution research?
Okay, the simple answer to that is that evolutionary biologists, population geneticists, still basically don't understand why the RH polymorphism is there. It's a real mystery as to why those genes do themselves. And the RH disease, okay, an RH positive fetus immunizes the mother against future Rh-positive fetuses. So you're right, the costs seem to be all in the wrong direction. So there's a bit of a mystery there. Though I would emphasize, we now treat Rh disease by giving a mother a dose of antibodies at birth. But notice now that we also know that there are fetal cells circulating in the mother's blood from very early on in the pregnancy, but they're not immunizing the mother. So there are all sorts of immunological questions here that we don't fully understand. I gave a good 2 months to trying to understand rhesus, and eventually I decided that I'd have to come back to it and try again. I think it's an interesting problem that is still unsolved. Who did I see? Make a decision. Okay. One of the problems is, I've got another slide on this one. Let's see if I can explain it. This is getting into difficult genetics. I came prepared for all the questions. What we're wanting to consider now, and let's this be the last question. Those people who want to go after this question, feel free to go, and I can talk for hours and hours. Let's even consider that the gene in the fetus that is causing the fetus to demand more from its mother comes from the mother. So when that gene first arises, it's rare. So the mother is going to have two kinds of genes. One of them, which when it's in the offspring, causes that offspring to be a greedy offspring, a guzzler, and the other one, when it's in the offspring, cause it to be a less greedy offspring, a sipper. So the mother now is having two kinds of offspring. And we're looking at the situation. Oops, let's go back there. I'm making the example of dividing a cake. So just even forgetting about the genes that the offspring get from the father, this cake represents all the reproductive effort that the mother puts into her offspring during her life. And on average, 50% of the offspring will be carrying one of the genes and 50% the other. Now, if the distribution of resources was fair, we would have a fair distribution of resources here, okay? Let's say the white ones are the guzzlers and the dark ones are the less greedy ones. Well, this is the situation where this is the optimal maternal division of the cake. However, notice that when a gene that causes offspring to be greedier comes in, the offspring that are taking extra resources are getting a larger slice of the cake, whereas the ones that don't carry that gene are getting less. And so even though maybe the mother's total number of offspring are reduced, these offspring are actually more fit than the other kinds of offspring, so that the gene will tend to increase in frequency because it's getting an unfair share of the cake. Now notice here that there were two genes in the mother. One of the genes in the mother is doing poorly. It's worse off. It's now only present in three offspring rather than in four offspring. So it's done poorly, whereas the other gene, rather than being in four medium-sized offspring, gets to be in three big-sized offspring, and that may be better off. So there is no... You've got to stop thinking at this case about the fitness of the mother. Different genes in the mother now have different fitnesses. And so these genes will tend to spread at the expense of other genes. Okay, and if these genes go to fixation, now all offspring are making greater demands, and so that the mother would be producing more offspring if the offspring weren't so demanding, but it's the stable outcome of the situation, because if an offspring starts being non-greedy, it's being exploited by all the other members of the litter or whatever. And so the point I'm making here is that in the end, actually nobody ends up winning. The gene for the offspring demanding more is able to spread because it exploits a different gene. But once that gene is eliminated, it's only playing against other greedy genes. So in a sense, this is a sign of the cost of the conflict. But the gene spreads when rare, because in the next generation also, the mother is heterozygous, carrying that gene, and her offspring that get the gene for extra demands do well, and the ones that get the other gene don't. Does that answer the question? Think about it. That is a difficult question. Let people... Yes.
We can see that marching orders. I'm very sorry. And it's a brilliant talk.
Thank you.